From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Robert Coles' unconventional life in medicine. Coles is a child psychiatrist who's called on theology, literature, and a political conscience to study the lives of children in crisis. Also today, Korean writer An Chung-yo. He translated Gone with the Wind, Roots, and The World According to Garp into Korean. Now Americans can read his own new novel about the Korean troops who fought in the Vietnam War. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Lee Dorsey, who had the hits Working in a Coal Mine and Yaya. And John Leonard reviews Günter Grass's new novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Robert Coles once described himself as a child psychiatrist who has tried to understand how children grow up in various parts of America under various social and economic circumstances. In understanding the inner life of children, he has looked beyond their relationships with their families to the larger social, cultural, and economic factors that shape their lives. Coles won a Pulitzer Prize for his series of books about children in crisis. He wrote about black children, white children, children in the North and South, the children of the poor and the affluent. Sociologist David Riesman summed up Coles' contribution as anti-stereotyping, showing how complicated and resilient people really are. Robert Coles is the author of 40 books and a professor of psychiatry and medical humanities at Harvard. His new book, The Call of Stories, is about using literature as a tool in understanding the complexity of human nature. I asked Coles to explain his mission as a child psychiatrist.
When I was in training in child psychiatry at the Children's Hospital in Boston in the 50s, I saw my mission to be one of working with children who had serious conventional psychiatric disorders such as school problems or phobias, and I also had a particular field of research in mind because I happened by historical accident to be a resident at the hospital in Boston when we had our last polio epidemic in the late 1950s. And I worked with a lot of children who were suddenly paralyzed by polio, the last epidemic in this country before the Salk vaccine came into widespread use. At that time, I learned a lot from those children about not only their adaptation to serious illness, but the moral questions that came up as they, at an early age, began to contemplate the possibility of death or serious lifelong illness. They asked questions that Job asked in the Old Testament, and that I guess we all ask as we get older and face the possibility of illness, and not to mention the end of life. I was struck by the moral intensity of some of those questions and the reflections that they shared with me, and I began to think that this might be my career as a child psychiatrist, because I noticed that there were some children also at the Children's Hospital who had leukemia and who were asking the same kinds of questions as they struggle with that disease. And of course, at that time, there was not the hope for leukemic children that there is now. All of this was interrupted by my military service under the old doctor's draft law that had all of us doctors put in 2 years in the military. And I was put in charge of an Air Force psychiatric hospital in Biloxi, Mississippi at the end of my training in psychiatry and child psychiatry. And this changed my life because suddenly I saw in Mississippi and Louisiana in 1960, 61, 62, suddenly I saw children going through hell in order to go into desegregated schools, facing mobs, being threatened with death and isolation, and all sorts of family jeopardy because of the obedience they were offering to the federal courts, which were ordering school desegregation at the time. And as I got to know these children and became involved with them, I had a new sense of my profession. Instead of doing work in hospitals and clinics with psychologically troubled children or children in psychological trouble because of the terrible medical illnesses they were struggling with, I saw myself as someone working in homes and in schools and, so to speak, on the streets or in neighborhoods away from the conventional medical settings, working with those children, trying to understand them and how they grew up and what their particular fate was as pioneers in school desegregation, or for that matter, white children in the South who were struggling to understand these sudden changes in their lives, having been told by their parents that, for instance, school desegregation would never take place.
So your work became studying children in different situations of crisis and in different social situations around the country.
In different social situations, and eventually that work became not only tied up with the civil rights movement, but with understanding children in a variety of social and economic and regional settings, poor children, well-to-do children, Appalachian children, migrant children, Indian children, Eskimo children, children of the rich for that matter. In my field, based on psychoanalytic child psychiatry, we tended to emphasize mothers and fathers and their particular relationship with children, not thinking usually of the social and cultural and economic and racial and regional and ethnic and national factors, if I may use that somewhat pompous word, factors which impinge upon the lives of children, the language they speak and the aspirations they get from a particular kind of neighborhood or a particular kind of school or from a particular tradition, whether it be the tradition of Hopi and Pueblo Indians or the tradition of well-to-do entrepreneurs or the tradition of migrant farm workers or people who live up the hills of Appalachia.
You know, it's interesting. You've had such a profound impact on child psychiatry. You actually started off as an English major. What led you into medicine?
I started off as an English major who wrote his thesis on the first two books of poems by William Carlos Williams, who also happened to be a physician and basically a pediatrician, a family doctor, we'd call him now, in family medicine. He worked with the immigrant poor of northern New Jersey, did most of his work not in Rutherford, but in Paterson and Passaic and Hackensack and various communities of industrial northern New Jersey. And I got to meet him as a result of the writing I did as an English major, and he became a wonderful mentor of mine, older friend, a person who inspired me to think about my own life and what I wanted to do with it. And the result was a shift from someone who I think was headed toward teaching English or maybe some interest in moral philosophy and theology, a shift toward medicine. I took pre-med courses and ultimately went to medical school. Not that I had a great time there, but I eventually loved being able to work with people on the wards and learn from them and be of some help to them, I hope and pray. But it was due to the influence of Dr. Williams, who was a great, great and inspiring force in my life, God rest his soul.
You once said that you were going to become a pediatrician yourself, but you found it too upsetting to watch children after they'd been given a shot.
Right.
You didn't want to watch them cry after you'd given them a needle.
Right.
Was that the real reason?
Yes. I found that I couldn't handle their difficulties with doctors without sharing those difficulties, I think, too much. So I tried to find another way of working with them than poking them with needles. And not that that doesn't desperately need to be done, but I didn't have the emotional equipment for doing it.
Well, you ended up studying psychiatry in a period that was dominated by Freud. Did you resist his thinking as a student?
No, I was trained in his thinking, both in Boston and in New Orleans. My analyst in New Orleans, I was analyzed in New Orleans, was the head of the New Orleans Psychoanalytic Institute at the time, and I very much still remain loyal to Freudian understanding, so to speak, but I also remain loyal to those who have taken that knowledge and extended it, such as Eric Erickson and Winnicott, Fairbairn, a whole group of analysts both in the United States and England.
Do you feel that Freudian thinking works well in the social, political, economic context that you've operated in?
it helps, but by no means is it meant to provide all the answers that one looks for. For that, one has to look to history, and one, I think, can look very profitably to novelists, to Tolstoy, to William Carlos Williams as an essayist and novelist, as well as poet, to George Eliot and Dickens, to all the traditional storytellers who have learned so much about the world around them and convey it with such patient willingness to comprehend complexity and ambiguity and irony and all of the contradictions of life without feeling the need to sweep all that they see and hear under the rug of theory and of overwrought generalization.
Well, looking to literature to help in understanding human nature is really the subject of your new book, The Call of Stories. And let me reintroduce you. My guest is Dr. Robert Coles, who's one of America's leading child psychiatrists. You found stories to be very important both in teaching but also in your work with children. I think you credit William Carlos Williams as helping to teach you about the importance of stories in the practice and teaching of medicine. He urged you to tell doctor stories. What did he mean by that?
He meant stories about individuals who are sick and who have one or another kind of encounter with a physician, which often, by the way, in our lives can have tremendous significance for us, even though we don't dwell upon those encounters. But if you stop and think, the listeners of this program would stop and think about those moments they've had with doctors, they're important moments. We're facing pain and maybe even jeopardy of our life itself. And who this person is who attends us and listens to us and talks to us can be very important. And usually there is, in that sense, something that goes on between two people. It's a story. The doctor, the patient, what they have to say, how they are with one another, and what they do to one another, emotionally, morally, spiritually, even, one hopes and prays.
Williams said to you that he was skeptical of the ability of great literature to save you and that books shouldn't be given that job. What does that mean to you, and how do you balance a statement like that with your interest in using literature to help your students understand human nature?
Well, what I was hearing was the skepticism of someone who himself had been a writer for so many years, both fiction, nonfiction, essays, plays even, who knew that ultimately we cannot turn to anything in an idolatrous way, that we can't set up literature or science or education or any particular aspect of our lives to be saving in a spiritual sense. I think he was speaking to someone who was having his own troubles with medical education and who was having his own troubles figuring out how to live his life and what to do with it, and who was turning to novels with a kind of hopefulness that perhaps drew upon religious energy for its purpose. And I think he was cautioning me that that ultimately we're saved in a way by the way we live our lives, not only by the thoughts we have or the reading we do. He was a great one, and this is important about him and maybe for all of us, certainly for me, as I think about life. He was reminding me that if we're going to, in a sense, be saved religiously and spiritually, it has to be by our conduct, not by the amount of reading we've done. And in that sense, he was struggling with what Tolstoy struggled with in the last half of his intellectual life and personal life, namely the question of not only the intellectual life and its nature, but what we do with that intellectual life, namely the question of conduct, moral conduct. It's a great thing to have all kinds of ideas, including moral thinking and moral ideas, but what do we do once we put the book down? Does the book, for instance, the novel, the literature, does it inspire us in some way in our everyday life? That's what he was getting at. And if it doesn't, he said, then the response is aesthetic, which is fine, intellectual, which is fine, but there's no connection between that and the lived life, and that, of course, the lack of that connection can be very sad.
Well, I want to talk with you more, but first we're going to have to take a short break. And my guest is Robert Coles, the child psychiatrist, and he has a new book which is called The Call of Stories. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, Robert Coles, is a child psychiatrist, a professor at Harvard, and the author of more than 40 books. His series on children in crisis won a Pulitzer Prize. His latest book, The Call of Stories, is about using literature to help understand human nature. Now, you have, I believe, three children of your own, who I assume are grown now.
Yeah.
And your wife has been a teacher, I believe, for most of her career?
Yes.
Now, has your expertise as a child psychiatrist and her expertise as a teacher ever been a burden at all in your roles as parents?
Oh, I suppose the biggest burden in our role, in my role as a parent, I don't want to speak for my wife. I suppose there's a danger for people like me in psychiatry to become too self-conscious. It's an occupational habit we have with our patients and with ourselves as the doctors of those patients, and I suppose you can carry that home and make a mess of things. Frankly, I think insofar as I've not done that, that is a tribute to my wife, who has systematically, if I may talk out of home and reveal a family situation, who has systematically for 30 years that we've been married, almost 30 years, 29, worked against that kind of self-consciousness. She's never been a great one for becoming all too conscious, self-consciously psychological with either with ourselves or with our children. So she has pushed me toward being the person I am rather than some kind of overly self-conscious and overly self-aware shrink at home. She certainly made sure that that hasn't taken place, thank God.
Mm-hmm. One of the books you've written is a biography of Dorothy Day, of the Catholic worker, and she committed her life to working for others. And you asked yourself in the introduction, did you ever want to live a life like that? And you answered, though I am one who has had to answer no, the question has haunted my life. How has that question haunted your life?
Well, it's haunted my life because, first of all, Dorothy Day meant a lot not only to me but to my mother, who used to read the Catholic worker every month, and who, in a way, introduced my brother and me to the Catholic worker tradition. I knew Dorothy Day very well and used to work in her soup kitchen on the Lower East Side. And later, when I was, quote, grown up, unquote, that is, a working man and doing the work I found to do in my life, I went back to see her and talked with her and wrote about her in a couple of books, actually. She's meant a lot to me and she's inspired me, but I also had to realize that the way she lived her life was not going to be the way I lived mine. Yet, differing in ways from her, I still think a lot of her and what her moral example has meant to me, to my wife, to my children, is just a big part of our lives. Frankly, if my wife had had her way, I think we would have lived a less comfortable life and a life nearer to that of Dorothy Day, but I was not brought up to be like that. And in a sense, I got mixed messages from my parents, at least from my mother, who on the one hand, I think, I know, admired Dorothy Day, but on the other hand, I think also admired the good, comfortable, upper-middle-class life, which was hers and which I think she wanted us to share. And I have not noticed that I've rebelled significantly from that.
You've been in the situation a lot, too, of studying children who were poor, but making, you know, a comfortable living yourself while studying them. I guess that's always been awkward for you.
And you can hear in the way I'm talking now how uncomfortable I'm made by all of this. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to resolve this. I am made uncomfortable by it, and yet I continue to do it. And it just shows you that, that some of us in the upper realms of the bourgeoisie manage to do well, and even if we are also, in our small ways, doing some fairly honorable work. I find this discussion unnerving, and I think probably it's revealing some of the moral tensions and qualms that I have. I don't know how to live up to some of the spiritual traditions of the Catholic worker movement, or for that matter, the spiritual traditions that the Old and New Testament offer us through the Hebrew prophets and the way Jesus lived his life, while at the same time being an American upper middle class professional man. I suppose I, at times, to be tough on myself and skeptical of myself, I suppose I try to have it both ways.
You know, it's interesting, in your work you've studied the crises of poor children. You've also studied the emotional and physical crises of middle class and affluent children. And I wonder if the pain of the middle class and affluent children seem any less compelling to you. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do, and I would say that not so. Fifth volume of Children of Crisis is called Privileged Ones, and it does indeed deal with the problems of children from well-to-do families, the moral ambiguities they struggle with, the spiritual questions they have in mind, the psychological tensions in some of these well-to-do, even rich families. Pain and confusion and perplexity and anguish are pain and confusion and perplexity and anguish. Whether the person who bears those qualities of mind be rich or poor, and I'm not about to start grading suffering by resort to the class background of the person. If a child is in pain, a child is in pain. On the other hand, I have to add that it's nice to be in pain and yet have the ability to be sent to, say, a doctor, or the ability to have certain kinds of privileges that make that pain considerably less at times. But the kind of pain I was describing among well-to-do children in that fifth volume of Children of Crisis was deep and honorable pain, insofar as all pain is honorable, and sometimes it wasn't the pain, in other words, of self-indulgence and moral deterioration. It was the pain of genuine and honest soul-searching on the part of those children. And even if the soul-searching was done beside a swimming pool or near a tennis court or in a very comfortable home, I feel it was honest soul-searching and deserves to be acknowledged as such and not demeaned by virtue of the upper-class background of the family.
If you were just starting out now professionally, what do you think you'd be studying?
There's a good question. How can you put yourself into another life? It's hard, but I would hope that if I was starting out now that I'd be interested in children still and in their lives in one way or another. I would hope that there's a lot still that needs to be done so that we understand more about how children grow up and how they struggle not only with psychological problems but moral and spiritual problems. I sometimes think of my work, if I may be a little prideful, as tied up with a kind of the documentary tradition, and I would hope that there'd be new opportunities if I were just going in the working life of a child psychiatrist to do that kind of documentary work. My hunch is if I went to medical school now that I might not go into child psychiatry. That I might want to go into what's called family medicine or maybe pediatrics, because there's a part of me that has always thought of myself deep down, if you want the way I think of myself when I do my work, has always thought of myself as primarily not a child psychiatrist or not, say, an English major who ended up writing books, but if you want to get to the bare bones, rock bottom self in my life as I do this work, I think of myself as a physician and a doctor who is very much interested in children and who enjoys being with them.
I don't know if this is an answerable question, but do you think of yourself as having had a happy childhood? What emotions do you feel looking back on your own?
I had a lucky childhood in the sense that my mother and father were able to offer my brother and me a lot. My brother's a professor of English now, has been for many years, and we both had from them, I think, a whole range of valuable experiences. My mother was a great lover of literature and interested in religion. Tolstoy was her great hero. In fact, she died reading Tolstoy. My father was a scientist, and so they had a range of interests and values that I think meant a lot to my brother and me, and they had their limitations, and at times, of course, believe me, I could be very disgruntled and rebellious, but I'm glad to have had them as parents. They only recently died in their 80s, and they were never uninteresting to talk with, except when I wanted to simply be away from them as the wayward, rebelling adolescent son.
Have you ever been in the position of treating friends or the children of friends?
I could have been, but I never did so. I've resisted that.
Why was that important to resist?
For the same reason that I've never wanted to be a pediatrician or a, quote, mind doctor, unquote, to my own family. I think one has to keep friendship apart and family apart from medicine and psychiatry and whatever. I think when it's too complicated involvement to mix with one's personal life.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me here.
Dr. Robert Coles' new book is called The Call of Stories, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. Coles is a professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with poet Adrienne Rich. Her recent poetry has followed a strict feminist political agenda and concerned itself with controversial issues, but the poems in her new book, Time's Power, combine the political with the personal. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Korean writer An Chung-yo is a veteran of the Vietnam War. Not much has been written about the Korean troops who served in Vietnam, but it's the subject of An's new novel. Coming up, we talk to the novelist and Vietnam veteran who also wrote the Korean translations of some of America's most popular novels. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks at how singer Lee Dorsey weathered New Orleans musical changes after his hits Working in a Coal Mine and Ya Ya. And book critic John Leonard reviews Show Your Tongue. It's a new novel by the German writer Günter Grass, who also wrote The Tin Drum. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Doreen McAllister. President Bush will seek a constitutional amendment to counter a Supreme Court decision that he says went too far in allowing political protesters to burn the American flag. The proposal drew mixed reactions from Congress and civil rights groups. While some view the president's action as a necessary defense of the flag, others fear that such an amendment could run against the First Amendment guarantees of freedom of speech. U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh today defended the Bush administration's civil rights record during the 18th annual convention of Operation Push outside Chicago. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports that members of the civil rights organization were less than impressed.
Thornburgh said he came to the convention to establish a dialogue on civil rights, but in the light of Supreme Court decisions that activists say have turned back the clock for minorities and women, the dialogue became heated. Arthur Kanoy, a professor of constitutional law at Rutgers University, asked the Attorney General why the administration won't support legislative responses to the Supreme Court rulings.
Why, in the commitment to the Constitution of the United States, which you have sworn to uphold, do you not take action now in support of these bills?
Professor Kanoy, I don't think it adds to the kind of dialogue that we are seeking to engage in to reduce them to the level of shouting matches.
Members of the audience, who had given Thornburgh a standing ovation at the beginning of the session, offered less enthusiastic applause as he left. I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Sources in Hong Kong say at least five intellectuals on Beijing's most wanted list escaped China through the British colony. The report indicates an escape route has been established to aid those fleeing the nationwide crackdown on those linked with the democracy movement. Also today, the 12-nation European community approved an embargo on arms sales to China. The Chinese government has also delayed the start of a Peace Corps program that would have sent 19 American volunteers to teach English in one of China's provinces. Peace Corps spokesman Jim Flanagan says the Chinese Education Association telephoned the U.S. Embassy in Beijing to inform the U.S. of its request for a delay.
The Peace Corps has received word from a sponsoring education exchange agency in China suggesting a postponement, and I underscore the word postponement, and a further discussion of when the Peace Corps volunteers will be able to go to China.
The Peace Corps visit to China would be the first to a communist country by Peace Corps volunteers. The United Mine Workers of America says it disagrees with a court order to end wildcat strikes, but says it will comply with the order. A U.S. district judge issued the temporary injunction late yesterday, ordering the miners to end their walkout. The order came at the request of the National Labor Relations Board. For the past 2 weeks, some 42,000 UMW members in 10 states have stayed off the job in sympathy with 1,900 UMW members who are striking against the Pittston Coal Company. This is NPR in Washington. Former Reagan administration aide Lynn Nossiger says he's pleased that a federal appeals court has overturned his conviction on illegal lobbying charges. In a 2-1 ruling, the appeals court said the prosecution in the case had to, but did not prove that Nossiger knew that his conduct was illegal when he lobbied his former colleagues less than a year after leaving the Reagan administration. The independent prosecutor who brought the case against Nossiger is reportedly considering an appeal of today's ruling. The Delaware River cleanup is proceeding slowly following this weekend's spill of more than 800,000 gallons of heating oil. Greg Allen of member station WHYY reports that the state of Delaware is suing the owner of the tanker that ran aground over the weekend.
Delaware filed the lawsuit in federal court today, alleging that negligence on the part of the crew of the tanker, the Presidente Rivera, led to the accident, which spilled more than 800,000 gallons of heating oil into the Delaware River.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says there are only two ways for a performer to survive the on-again, off-again nature of the New Orleans music scene with any dignity. You can have a career doing one thing well, like Fats Domino, or you can be completely indifferent to whether you have a career at all, like Lee Dorsey.
Oh, shortening bread.
New Orleans may be one of the cradles of rock and roll, but during its heyday, it was also a very fashion-conscious place. If you had the wrong sound, if you were in the slightest old-fashioned, you were scorned. One thing this meant was that there were a lot of old-timers around town just waiting for a new generation of rock and roll scholars to seek them out and rediscover them. But it also meant that you could vanish without a trace. That's why Lee Dorsey is such an unusual figure in New Orleans musical history. His career started in 1961 and lasted until he decided it was over. Along the way, he weathered the changes in the city's music scene.
Oh, well, I'm sitting here la-la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh, sitting here la-la, waiting for my ya-ya. It sounds funny, but I don't believe she's coming.
Dorsey was a 35-year-old retired boxer when he decided to take up music in 1961. He'd made a couple of local records that hadn't done anything when he sought out Bobby Robinson, owner of New York's Fire Records label. Robinson thought Dorsey had talent, but no material, so together they went to a bar to figure out what to do. Robinson had heard some kids in Dorsey's yard singing a chant. When they rewrote it together, it turned into Ya Ya, a number one hit for weeks and weeks. But after his follow-up, Do Re Mi, flopped, Dorsey had the first dry spot in his career. He was saved when the young arranger he'd used on his first record, Alan Toussaint, came back from a stint in the Army. Toussaint and his partner, Marshall Seahorn, were looking for talent, and he remembered the old guy he'd worked with 4 years earlier. Taking a tune that exploited a hot dance, adding a list of cities to the lyrics, always a sure way to get airplay in those towns, and using his mother-in-law's name, Toussaint handed Dorsey his second hit. It was one of the summer of 1965's biggest songs, and Dorsey was on his way, again. Part of the reason the records did so well was the band, consisting of Toussaint on piano and an act called the Meters, which was mostly a family named Neville. They were good at tricky rhythms.
Get out my life, woman. You don't love me.
Really, during a period when Stax and Motown were putting ever more complex arrangements behind their artists, it was almost a relief to hear the minimalism the Meters managed on Dorsey's hits.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to step down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down.
5 o'clock in the morning, I'm already up and gone.
But Alan Toussaint had ambitions, and his songwriting got too arty for the charts. After 1967 was over, so was Lee Dorsey again. But he believed in Toussaint, and vice versa. And in 1970, they hit the charts with a single, Yes We Can, and an album loaded with delights like this.
Sneaking silent through the alley, trying to keep her out of sight. Sneaking silent through the alley, and up pops my wife.
Toussaint's reputation grew as his record sales slipped. Dorsey, meanwhile, had been running an auto salvage yard in the suburbs, so he had an income. He stuck with his old friend, and in 1978, they made one last album together. Night People would probably have done better if the record company hadn't died just after it came out. And this time, Lee Dorsey retired to his junkyard, which he'd tell visitors he preferred to the music business anyway. He played locally, and in 1986, he died at home of a respiratory disease, 60 years old, and content knowing he'd written several important chapters in the history of New Orleans rock and roll.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
I can't deal since you walked out on me. Yeah. Holy smoke, what you doing to me? Yeah. I can't eat, I can't sleep since you walked out on me. Yeah. Holy cow, what you doing, child?
This is Fresh Air. Korean writer An Chung-yo has written a novel about a subject few Americans know much about, the Korean troops that fought in the Vietnam War. The Korean army was there at the request of the Americans. An Chung-yo served as a corporal in Vietnam. When he returned home, he wrote a column about the war for one of Korea's English newspapers. He also made his living translating Korean novels into English and translating American bestsellers into Korean. He recently translated his own novel, White Badge, into English, and it's just been published by Soho Press. He told me that he volunteered to go to Vietnam to fulfill his compulsory military duty. I asked him what he thought he would find once he got there.
It's a very strange feeling, but you know, when you are young, you think war is something romantic. And I think many young people have that kind of romanticizing ideas about war and, well, even something about death. And I thought I was getting into something very romantic and very heroic and something I could watch. That was my feeling.
Oh, that it would be like a big movie.
Oh, yes.
And how long did it take before you realized it wasn't going to be like a movie?
Well, about 2 months when I saw the first four men die.
You've said that frequently the Koreans fighting in Vietnam weren't listed in the casualty list, that the Korean deaths weren't counted as part of the official figures. Do you know how that happened, why that happened?
Well, the Korean soldiers were very strange situation at the time. We were going to Vietnam to fight, well, in a way, for the Vietnamese, but actually for the Americans, because we were going there at the demand of the American government. So when the government decided to send the troops to Vietnam, the intellectuals objected to it because it was like a national mercenaries going to the war, and the government at the time it was the military government, and the government did not want any bad opinions and objections about the war, so they used to report the winning stories all the time. And there was not, I don't remember any story reporting the Korean casualties or loss.
One of the characters in your novel is never able to adjust after the war, mm-hmm. and is on the verge of suicide. Mm-hmm. Did you have a hard time adjusting yourself? It's been a problem I know a lot of American veterans faced when they came back.
No, not for me. I kept writing about the experience I had there, and I contributed my stories to the newspapers, Vietnamese papers, and I ran a column in a Korean newspaper, which is published in English. So maybe I got much consolation out of my writing.
Mm-hmm. Now, your new novel, White Badge, is the first novel by a Korean published by an American house.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a lifelong ambition of yours to be published in the States?
Oh, yes, of course.
Why?
It's very hard for a writer to answer why he writes, but I started writing in English while I was in college. So for 25 years, I wrote about 15 novels in English and collected a lot of rejection slips and then gave up. I got myself established as a writer in Korea, and then the old ambition, it just urged me to come to the States and try once more. So I tried, and this time it worked.
You've translated novels from English into Korean and from Korean into English.
Yes.
First of all, can you tell us some of the novels that we might know that you've translated from English into Korean?
The World According to Garp, Gone with the Wind, Thornburrs, and Roots. Well, there are so many others.
What gives you a lot of problems when you're working from English into Korean? I'm thinking, for instance, that there might be idioms, dialects that don't easily translate. How do you handle that?
Well, I have my own ways, but I cannot explain it to you because you don't know Korean.
Good point.
And, for instance, the most difficult dialogues in the novels that for me to translate is the black people's dialogue. It is sometimes you cannot translate it grammatically, and in Korea there are certain ways certain ways I cannot explain, but there are very strange but certain ways I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I have been translating for almost 13 years, and if you work on something for 13 years, you get to know some tricks.
Now, the Korean War was fought while you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Did the war bring a lot of American culture into Korea?
I think that is the beginning when the American culture made its presence conspicuous in Korea. Because so many Americans were there, and at the time, Koreans had almost nothing. And they were so suffering, and everything American looked so great to us when we were a child. And that is the beginning of a major influence of the American culture over the Korean culture. That's my personal opinion, but many people will agree with me.
Your main character in your novel, White Badge, like mm-hmm. you, grew up during the Korean War, and the character says that in wartime, soldiers and men and women and even children had to do things that they would not do in normal society. Mm. Were you and your family in that kind of position of doing extreme things during the war or being, forced to emigrate from where you lived during the war?
Yes, of course, we did certain things, that would be for us, we would feel too shameful, but we had to do that.
What kinds of things?
Well, picking garbage, for instance, and I don't want to elaborate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any censorship in Korea that writers are up against?
Right now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it is they are rather free to speak and write about what they wanted to say and write, comparatively speaking. But until about 3 years ago, there was almost a total suppression of the expression by the writers, and the writers could not say anything bad about the government or the military. But it is now improving. The situation is improving, and the writers many writers start to write about what they have not been able to say and write about.
When was your novel White Badge published in Korea? And was that during the period of censorship or after?
Yes, it was during the hard censorships. And it was first published in a magazine in 1983, and it was supposed to be carried in the magazine in 4 installments. And when it ran for 2 installments, the government closed down the magazine. And then 2 years later, it was published as a book, one volume. That was 1985. And in 1987, I came to the States to translate into English and get it published here.
What kind of reception has your book gotten in Korea?
In Korea? Since it was the first book about Vietnam, which nobody had been talking about, the critics, well, the only reaction I could tangibly see were the reviews by the literary critics. And they demanded much more from me because they said, well, you've been to the war and you must know much more than this. But, they wanted some messages and some accusations and some some ideological things. But that was not the purpose for me to write the book. I wanted to write the human stories about the soldiers with whom I fought and went through the war. So, well, they probably demanded me more messages because they wanted they needed somebody to say something about it and know something about it. But I didn't want to do that because I'm a writer who writes about people, not about ideas.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing and your life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Korean writer An Chung-yo, his novel White Badge is published by Soho Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, the American flag is back in the news today.
Lots of talk about the American flag. Last week, the Supreme Court said it would not be illegal to burn the flag in protest, and there's been much protest of that. And this morning, President Bush at a news conference said he wanted to see the matter remedied and is calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn the decision by the Supreme Court. We'll have a reaction to that announcement from around the country and from Capitol Hill. Also, David Malpas has a report on a munitions plant now under construction, one the Army plans to shut down before it even opens. And we'll talk with a newspaper editor in Philadelphia, Mississippi, who wants to see murder charges brought against those responsible for the killings of 3 civil rights workers in 1964.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In novels like Tin Drum, The Rat, and Dog Years, Günter Grass has charted Germany's shift from conquering warrior to defeated nation and now back to industrial giant. His new book, Show Your Tongue, grew out of a trip to Calcutta. Grass's sketches illustrate his text. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
Imagine if Norman Mailer could bring himself to go to Israel, or Saul Bellow, that Mandarin, to Beijing, or Toni Morrison to Accra or Brazzaville. Günter Grass leaves the West for Calcutta because he's disgusted. What disgusts him are the two Germanies growing ever more alike, gobbledygook and social democratic neither nor, frozen cheerfulness and stylized warmth behind burglar-proof glass. He can't stand people whose main concerns are television at breakfast and the half-life of their vegetables, clearance sales and postmodern telephone booths, relationships in easily transported boxes, and required courses in how to cope with grief. What he finds during the 6 months of his second visit to Calcutta is a sense of shame. Grass determines to measure everything, including himself, by Calcutta, a city that jolts out of focus, wrenches askew, that plummets, he says, as if an expressionist had invented this rush of streets for a woodcut of epileptic collapse. Only the sleepers remain real. It's a city he loves in spite of itself, for its Bengali lyrics and its sitar melancholy and its moonlit courtyards, a city damned to offer lodgings to every human misery. In his diary, and in his violent, smudgy drawings, and little poems in the regrettable manner of those he wrote for his novel, The Rat, He'll paint for us the acrid smoke of open fires fed with cakes of dried cow dung, vultures and crows and children living on a garbage dump, bodies wrapped like mummies, rows of child bundles, old women on funeral pyres at the crematorium, sticking out from under the shrouds, rubbed with ghee, a clarified butter, so that their skulls glisten. Against the architecture of his own modern Germany, he will celebrate the slum hovels of Calcutta, created from bare necessity. Set one of these hovels down next to the Deutsche Bank high-rise in Frankfurt. That high-rise, quote, that hewn granite sculpture, loves only itself. Beautiful, maybe, but its business is to endorse, quote, the circulation of money stamped valid for eternity. If, says Grass, you replaced that granite celebrating its flawless self and set down instead one single slum hovel as authentic as want had made it, right next to the glassy arrogance of the Deutsche Bank, beauty would at once be on the side of the hovel, and truth too, even the future. Grass all but screams. The mirrored art of all those palaces consecrated to money would fall to its knees, because the slum hovel belongs to tomorrow. Who will make the revolution that saves Calcutta? Not Marx, says Grass, nor Mao. He looks to Kali, goddess of destruction, the terrible black mother with 10 arms and a sword and a spear and a shield and a strangling noose, a necklace of skulls and a girdle of severed hands. This is the Kali we see in the temples, under a layer of black enamel, eyes ringed, palms red, surrounded by women with Dracula teeth, holding tiny men in their talons, biting off heads and hands and sexual organs. In blood-drunk ecstasy, Kali cast down her own consort, Siva, and danced on his stomach, and then, because she was ashamed of herself, she stuck out her tongue. Gunter Grass sticks out his tongue.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Show Your Tongue by Gunter Grass. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, the lighter side of being paralyzed for life. Cartoonist John Callahan is a paraplegic, and many of his funniest cartoons are about the disabled, but they make some people too uncomfortable to laugh. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of compositions by American composer Virgil Thompson. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg lets us know when using the word shall is just pretentious, not to mention grammatically incorrect. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Liz Trubert and Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.